Information, Please, presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts and treat yourself to a glass of cool, refreshing Canada Dry ginger ale. Every week at this time, Canada Dry presents Information, Please. Join in the fun and play the game of Q&A with a quartet who seem to know almost everything. You may submit from 1 to 3 original questions. For every question our quartet fails to answer, the sender gets $10 with the compliments of Canada Dry. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. So you can make $15 if our experts miss out, which they occasionally do. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was submitted first. All questions become the property of Information Please and should be addressed to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City. And now may I present our master of ceremonies, Mr. Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please is an unrehearsed and go-as-you-please program. And seated opposite me are four men who will do their darndest to answer your questions and, if they can, to start arguments about them. The experts this evening include our two regulars, Franklin P. Adams, otherwise known as FPA, who is conductor of New York Post's column, The Cunning Tower, and John Curran, sports authority who does his best to take all knowledge for his province. Our two guests of honor are the well-known writer of fiction, Clarence Buddington Kellen, whose story Arizona is now being filmed, and the eminent naturalist, deep-sea authority, and explorer, Mr. William Beebe. Now, should they miss a question, Canada Dry is happy to pay out $10 to the sender, plus $5 for the use of the question itself. Now, gentlemen, if you're ready, I am. Mrs. W.W. Brown of Belleville, New Jersey, won't rest peacefully until she knows why water rolls off a duck's back. Now, Mr. Kim, we've got a real naturalist here this evening, and we're going to give seed plate to him. Mr. Beebe, why does water roll off a duck's back?
Because of the oil on the feathers.
Because of the oil on the feathers. That seems to me a perfectly easy answer to a very easy question. Mr. Beebe, could that duck possibly be the famous one we've all heard about, the oily boy that catches the worm? That was a very easy question. Just to start, our eminent naturalist off. We'll see if we can't catch him a little later on in the evening. Kay Rogers of Brooklyn, New York, wants to know what sports reporters meant very recently when they wrote the following phrases, which we quote direct. The first phrase is, Nelson jumped a stymie on the 32nd. What does that mean? Mr. Kellen.
A stymie is when the golf ball is between the hole and the wall of the fellow who's putting.
Right. And in this
and he has to use a niblick or something to jump his ball over to get it into the cup.
Right. And is there a particular case that the sports reporter was referring to here? Nelson jumped a stymie on the 32nd?
It must be one where he wouldn't have referred to it.
Quite right. Shrewd, very shrewd, Mr. Kellen. What is the exact incident, Mr. Kellen?
I take it that he was describing the final match for the PGA Championship between Byron Nelson and Pickard, which was won by Pickard on the 37th hole at Pomonac Country Club.
Yes, despite, Mr. Kellen, this remarkable shot of Nelson.
Right.
Very good. All right. Should say, for the benefit of the radio audience, that they should not give too much credit to Mr. Kellen. He himself is an amateur golfer of no mean stature. Am I right?
Stature is right, but golf not.
The major is unbecoming.
Means all right.
The major's unbecoming conduct drew a penalty. What does that phrase mean to you, sports authorities? Mr. Curran.
That refers to a little unpleasantness at the polo grounds in a ball game. When Billy Jurgis of the Giants and Major Kurth, the umpire, got into a row and exchanged very light blows.
Who won?
That was
Ford Frick.
Yes, Ford Frick.
Ford Frick won, Adam?
$200 worth.
$150. Never exaggerate, Karen.
$150 a topic.
Third and last on the sports phrases, quote, Don Meade gets a double, close quote. Meaning what? Miss Adams.
Won two races in a meet.
Who did?
What? John Meade, the jockey.
He's a jockey. Won two races on what day, Mr. Adams?
That I wouldn't know.
I have a feeling that I'm getting on that. On July 17th in Empire City, what two horses? Remember two horses there were? Circus and I think Montaigne or Montagna, I'm not sure. 3 out of 3 on that. We still got to get them down $10 worth. Perhaps this will do it. A question from Malcolm Russell of this city. Want you to explain or identify four words sound very much alike. The first is jingo, the second bingo, third dingo, fourth wingo. Does not include bingo, the well-known substitute for the motion picture industry. The first is jingo. Jingo is what? Mr. Kieran.
A jingo is a native of a country who yells like the Dickens for his flag and wants to fight everybody who doesn't yell as loud as he does.
Quite right. And what's the word, what's the derivation of it? How do we happen to use that word, jingo?
Oh, I think it comes from the old expletive by jingo.
Yes, but that itself was made famous. How?
Mr. Adams.
Mr. Adams?
We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's a song that I think the Britishers sang in 1878 when resentment was being stirred up against Russia.
We've got the something, we've got the something, we've got the ships, we have the money too.
Let's see, we don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do, we've got the men, we've got
the ships.
Got the ships, we've got the money too.
I didn't know the tune either.
Neither did I. I wasn't giving it to you. Now, mingo, M-I-N-G-O, means what to you gentlemen? It's curing.
Mingo is the term applied to one of the Huron tribe, especially in The Last of the Mohicans by James Fenimore Cooper.
That's perfectly all right if you can assure me that Iroquois and Huron are the same, or approximately the same.
Well, I know that Hawkeye calls him a nasty Mingo in the book, and he was a Huron and a member, and all I can refer you is to James Fenimore Cooper. I wasn't personally acquainted with the gentleman.
I doubt
it. Mr. Chair, and I'm sure that the Iroquois and the Hurons are sufficiently nearly related for me to give you 100% on your answer. What's a dingo, D-I-N-G-O? Mr. Beatty.
Wild dog of Australia.
A wild dog of Australia. Mr. Beatty just gets the answers correct and just stands pat. That's quite right. Wingo, W-I-N-G-O, Mr. Adams.
Wingo used to be a catcher for St. Louis.
That's perfectly right, Mr. Adams.
Well.
Well, why do you look that way, Mr. Adams? That's correct. Absolutely correct. Ivy Wingo, former Major League Baseball player I have. Very good on your ingos, gentlemen. Now let's check the next one from Mr. E. Nathan of Montreal, Canada. Why would you prefer not to meet the following in the water? The first is a piranha, which I'm no doubt mispronouncing. Mr. Beatty.
Well, I've met him in the water, and he's very unpleasant.
Really? What is a piranha, Mr. Beatty?
Piranha is a fish in South America, about 18 inches long, with triangular teeth, and every time he takes a bite, a little circular bit of flesh comes out. I've seen a dog pull down in a minute.
Did you ever meet one at close quarters, Mr. Beatty?
Not that I know.
You never were bitten by a piranha? I thought I could make you show your scars to the radio audience. That's quite right. Why wouldn't you like to meet a water moccasin in the water? But why should one meet any of these things in the water? I don't know. Mr. Kieran.
Well, a water moccasin is a venomous snake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's common in Florida, along the golf courses, so it isn't wise to get into water hazards down on the Florida golf courses.
That's something you remember, Mr. Kellen, when you're down on those. poisonous water serpent. Can it kill?
I don't think that its bite is necessarily fatal.
Not necessarily, but death's a result, oh yes.
Good thing to know. Now, a torpedo or cramp fish, why wouldn't you want to meet that? Mr. Beatty.
I would. It's rather exciting.
What a brave man.
They just give out a little shock of electricity and it's
a new line. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That might be stimulating. It says here that the electric shock is sufficient to paralyze the arms temporarily, which sounds hardly pleasant.
Very temporarily and hardly paralyzed.
You found the torpedo fish perfectly all right to me in the water.
Right.
That's a brave explorer, Biggie. All right, the stingaree. Why wouldn't you want to meet a stingaree? Or perhaps Mr. Beatty would like to meet a stingaree. Mr. Beatty?
No, I would not. They're a ray, kind of a red flat fish related to the sharks, and the sting has a poison which is very bad.
Well, does the danger lie in the sting, and the poisonous sting?
In stepping on it and having it enter the flesh.
Having the sting
at the face.
I thought the trouble was that it had a sharp, bony spine with the...
Well, let me say
teeth.
Sting, that is. On the tail.
I thought
sharp,
it was
bony spine, exactly on the tail. And it has no poison sac. It's the mucus of the skin. But the wound sometimes will never heal.
Okay.
Gentlemen, I stay on land.
Adam, I'm just a fearful. Mr. Beatty, this is quite off the record. You don't mind committing yourself, I'm sure. Is the octopus as dangerous as people seem to think the octopus is? Have you, you've met Octopus Pete, Bob? Octopus Pete, Bob?
Octopuses.
An octopus.
No, all they do is try to get away from them. It's the most difficult thing to catch an octopus, you can imagine.
And if they should wind their tentacles around you, what would happen?
Then that means you've got them and you can come ashore and rejoice.
Oh, you've got that?
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Bibby, you seem to have had no thrills at all whatsoever in your occupation. Like octopuses, stingarees, torpedoes, cramped fish. Mr. William E. Quinn of Springfield, Missouri, has concocted a pretty little question concerning embarrassing situations in the lives of certain gentlemen of fiction. Now, I know that Mr. Kelland is a fiction writer. Mr. Beatty, of course, you are not a fiction
writer.
I
never embarrass my heroes, though.
See what you can do with this. What genial bachelor, unexpectedly embraced by a widow, found himself involved in a breach of promise suit? Mr. Kelland.
Mr. Pickwick.
Mr. Pickwick of what book?
Pickwick Papers.
Very good, Mr. Kelland. That's quite right. Mr. Samuel Pickwick was embraced temporarily by the widow Bardell and got into a lot of trouble as a result of it. What ardent lover, to avoid complications with a lady's husband, concealed himself in a clothes basket? Mr. Quinn's imagination seems to run along one line this evening. Mr. Kieran.
Sir John Falstaff.
In what the play?
Merry Wives of Windsor.
Very good, Mr. Kieran. Very good. Sir John Falstaff. Who was the captain on horseback who, because of two bottles of wine, missed his wife twice on their wedding day? I don't know what he was throwing at her. He missed his wife twice on their wedding day. Miss Cure.
John Gilpin.
John Gilpin. And where will you find that story?
You will find that story in a metrical tale.
John
called
Credit and Renown, a train band captain.
That's he
was
threatened by Cowper.
You're listening to a competitive spiel between Mr. Kelland and Mr. Cure. With Mr. Kelland coming out. Adams has now entered the competition. That's quite right. John Gilpin and the Diverting History of John Gilpin by the English poet Cowper, or Cooper, as he is sometimes known. And those of the radio audience who want to know how all this happened, the captain on horseback, the two bottles of wine, and so forth, will have to read the poem. We have no time tonight. Who failed, this is the last one, who failed to win his lady with a little cup of coffee? Who failed to win his lady with a little cup of coffee? I think I've got him. Darling, I've got him. The first time this evening. I'm sorry, gentlemen, it was the villain to whom the working girl said, "You may tempt the upper classes with your villainous demi-tasses, but heaven will protect the working girl." That's one wrong. We had to get 4 out of 4. And so Mr. Quinn will get $10, courtesy of Canada Drive, plus $5 for the use of the press. Mr. Adams, do you remember where that song was sung, "Heaven Will Protect the Working Girl"? Who sang it?
Mary Dressler.
Mary Dressler, yes. And what play? I guess it wasn't a movie. It must have been a play.
I don't know. Might have been Tilly's Nightmare.
It was Tilly's Nightmare. Never say might. Very well. Now we peer into our cash register and we find that the hoard of gold has been reduced by the sum of $10. And while you...
A drop in the bucket.
Yes, it's nothing practically. While the lucky winner is rejoicing at the good news, we'll listen to a word from Mr. Milton Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Paddleman. Some minor philosopher once said that if business interferes with pleasure, give up the business. Fortunately, Canada Dry can afford to ignore this advice, for Canada Dry's business happens to be closely connected with pleasure. Your pleasure during those carefree times when you're reading, playing, or just talking. The close companion of those pleasant moments is often a long, cool drink, one of whose ingredients is sparkling Canada Dry water. This bright, lively club soda in a tall drink marks the difference between mediocrity and excellence. Its millions of tinier bubbles enable Canada Dry water to blend more completely, thus pointing up the flavor of the drink and making it livelier, more sparkling, and more lasting. So, when you're preparing for pleasure, make it your business to get in a good supply of the finest club soda. Your family and friends will admire your foresight when you serve them sparkling Canada Dry water.
No pinpoint carbonation?
Adam, that's in the bottle, even.
Oh.
The discourse. Which was waiting for, by the way, was clicked off at 57.5 seconds. Getting more and more precise on this program. Now we'll start in the second part of the evening with a question from Mr. Jerry Vogel of this city. You gentlemen are all old enough, I think, to have been stage door Johnnies at one time or another. And if you were stage door Johnnies some years ago, you might have heard the following songs which are going to be played. I'm going to ask you, for what actress, after the performance of what play, Would you be waiting at the stage door after you had heard each of them? Which is my idea of a remarkable sentence. It's perfectly correct. Now, we're going to play these songs one after the other, and you're going to tell me what actress is associated in your mind with them and what play. Let's have the first. That take you back, gentlemen? Mr. Beebe.
Lillian
our first maid to a giant. I beg pardon?
Lillian Russell?
No, I'm awfully sorry. Awfully sorry. Mr. Adams.
Edna Wallace Hopper.
That's quite correct. We'll have to count the information, please, as a whole wrong because of Mr. Beebe's enthusiasm for Lillian Russell. Edna Wallace Hopper is correct. And what play,
Mr. Floridora.
Floridora, that's quite correct. Now let's have a second. I wish I could describe the pleased smile on the faces of these gentlemen all over 35, may I ask? Adams?
I think that's Lillian Russell.
Ah, that is Lillian Russell, yes. Mr. Beebe, Lillian Russell. Mr. Beebe, Mr. Adams just took Lillian Russell away from
Come Down, My Evening Star.
Come Down, My Evening Star, and what play, Mr. Adams?
I don't know, but it was Weber and Fields.
It was. Weber and Fields Review, quite right. Very good memory you have for these days, Mr. Adams.
I was at no stage door then. I was in another city.
Let's have the third. One or two more notes of that. A little more, Miss Kellen. They're in a dream, these four gentlemen.
My name is
Sam. Miss Kellen. Miss Adams.
I gotta wait till I finish.
Mr. Adams has got to whistle the entire song, apparently. Got it now, Mr. Adams? Sorry, it's, yes, Mr. Adams.
Bessie McCoy.
Oh, that's right. Bessie McCoy. Very good. You remember the show?
Yes, I waited there.
What one was it, Mr. Adams?
The show was The Three Twins.
The Three Twins. And what's the song called?
Yama Yama.
You bet, Mr. Adams. That's absolutely right. You dredged that up right out of your subconscious.
Seems like yesterday.
Let's have the fourth and last. How about that?
I don't know who sang it, but it's Hello Frisco.
It is Hello Frisco, and it's sung by...
Somebody in the Follies.
You got half of it. Now, let's have a guess, Mr. Adams. Somebody in the Ziegfeld Follies? Oh, tell me, Mr. Adams.
I don't know.
Oh, tell me. Can I get it out of you? Ina Clare. Ina Clare is the answer. Well, I think we're going to pay out $10 to Mr. Jerry Vogel on that one. On account of Mr. Beebe coming in on Lillian Russell that way. Adams did beautifully on these old-time songs, I must say. Now, the next question from Ann Lee Goodman, of Peekskill, of this state, has to do with what we might call inconsistencies or misstatements of fact in the following famous lines, some of them from poetry and one of them from prose. Each of these lines has a misstatement in it. There's a line from, two lines rather, from Keats's famous sonnet on first looking into Chapman's...
Never mind.
Pardon, Mr. Curran? You don't want me to even to read the line?
I know it.
You're upsetting my routine.
All right.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Curran.
It should have been Balboa.
And you want to give us the line?
Yes, or when like the stout Cortez, when with eagle eye, he stared at the Pacific and all his men.
Silent on a peak in Darien.
That's the last word part of silent on a peak in Darien.
It wasn't Cortez who discovered
it. It was Balboa.
Balboa.
Balboa so walk next.
I, you know, we don't have to have a program at all, Mr. Curran. We don't have things in advance. Well, now, Mr. Curran, the next, I'm a little afraid of saying anything about the next, so I won't tell you this from Hamlet. I suppose you're going to tell me what I'm going to say now if I say the next is from Hamlet. Hamlet says he's soliloquizing, and he talks about wanting to commit suicide, except that he's prevented from doing so by the following. But that, I beg your pardon, Mr. Do you know that, too?
You mean about the place from whose born no traveler returns?
That's right.
And his own father had just returned?
Oh, Mr. Chen, this is dreadful. Setting the entire program. He's quite right. The lines are, but the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns, puzzles the will. The undiscovered country, of course, is the where we go after death. And Hamlet, who speaks the lines, has just in a previous scene spoken to the ghost of his father, which makes the line seem somewhat absurd, as Mr. Curran knew in advance. Mr. Garrett, how much will you take to keep quiet?
Hush money, that is.
Here's a phrase, very famous. The world will little note, no long remember what we say here. What's wrong about that? All right, Mr. Kieran.
Why, the world will long note and long remember what he said there.
Who said where?
Abraham Lincoln at the dedication speech on the field at Gettysburg.
Quite right. That was one of the worst guesses that Abraham Lincoln ever made. It's an immortal address, of course. And the dawn comes up like thunder out at... Oh, Mr. Kieran. Let me finish my sentence. I have a little work to do here, too. And the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. Mr. Beebe.
Mandalay.
It's from Mandalay. What's wrong with the two lines?
Well, China isn't across the bay.
Where is China in relation to Mandalay?
It is to the west instead of the east.
Well, is there any water between Mandalay and the mainland of southern China?
Not a drop, yes, except rivers.
Except rivers, of course. So Kipling made a very bad geographical error there, didn't he? How did he happen to make it, do you think?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Isn't it astonishing that Kipling, who lived in India and knew the Far East so well, should have put a bay between Mandalay, which is in Burma, and China? It reminds me of the time when old Sam Johnson was interrupted by a lady who claimed to detect him in an error of fact. And she said, what'd you say, Mr. Kieran?
She said, why did you define pastern as the knee of a horse in your dictionary?
I didn't know that. And what did he say?
Ignorance, madam. Pure ignorance.
All right. I have a true suspicion that I'm going to be fired. Guys, we got all on that, too. See what we can do with the next one. From P. Sloan of Memphis, Tennessee. These have to do with mammals. Now, you all know what mammals are. An M-A-M-M-A-L. Find it in the Bible. You can't worship God and mammal. Identify these mammals. The first mammal flies as its only real means of locomotion. What mammal would that be? Mr. Beebe?
Bat.
The bat, yes. It swims as its only real means of locomotion. Mr. Turin?
A whale.
A whale. It lays eggs. Mr. Beebe?
Duck-billed platypus.
What is the duck-billed platypus?
It is related to the echidna.
That's very transparent.
That's a song. That's a song.
What's the song called?
Duck-billed platypus, don't you try to two-time me.
What is the echidna?
Well, they're both mammals of Australia, and they just barely lay eggs because the eggs burst almost at once and the youngsters come out.
But they still are mammals, even though they lay eggs. The duck-billed platypus. Very good. What does the word platypus mean, Mr. Beebe? He turns to Mr. Kieran.
The thing with the duck bill.
Yes, flat-foot, I think.
Broad-foot from the Greek. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kieran's Greek. Broad-foot is what it means. What mammal dunks its food before eating it? Gentlemen, don't tell me the dunk-billed platypus, because I will not accept that one. All right, Mr. Beebe. Mr. Kieran, don't fight, gentlemen. I'll take either one of you. Mr. Kieran.
Raccoon.
Oh, and that was Mr. Beebe saying raccoon. What does the raccoon do, actually, Mr. Beebe? Does it actually dunk its food before
it washes eats? Every piece of food that it eats.
Why does it do that?
It even takes a fish out of the water and then washes it.
Finicky little animal, isn't it?
Very.
Is it the only animal you know that does that? Outside of Eddie Cantor?
Yes.
Okay. Very well. We've got the complete identification on these mammals. See what you can do with the following from Anne Shiley of Washington, D.C. Give the origin or a famous application of each of the following pairs of words. There are three of them. You have to get all of them. Blood and iron. What does the phrase blood and iron mean to you? Mr. Kieran.
Well, that was a phrase used by the Kaiser in Germany to explain the doctrine that was needed to put Germany in its place in the sun.
Yes, Bismarck. He got it from Bismarck. That's correct. It's a Bismarck tradition that is apparently not dead yet. Blood and iron. Cakes and ale. Cakes and ale. What does that mean to any of you gentlemen? Cakes and ale? And Mr. Kieran again.
It comes from Twelfth Night.
What act?
About the second or third act.
Hope for one.
And one of the characters says to that Malvolio, dost thou think because thou art virtuous there shall be no more cakes and ale?
Question mark.
Question mark.
Yes, that's right. Now, that's correct. And also,
end quote.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Well, I don't think we can get him down this evening, Mr. Adams. It's no use. I've been trying hard. Divide and rule. What does the phrase mean to you, gentlemen? Divide and rule. I see before me the hand of Mr. Kieran. Like black spots before my eyes. All right, Mr. Kieran.
Divide and rule was the political rule of one of the old houses in on the continent. And it's in French, I think. Divide et régner.
Yes, it's in several languages. Originally, I think in Latin. Divide et impera.
That's right. That's right. To break up, keep all those savage tribes separated so that the Roman rule at the time would keep them separately in subjection. If they joined together, they would overthrow the Roman invaders.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chairman. The policy was used later on by Austria-Hungary after 1867. Well, what can we do with this one? From John Coulthard of Modesto, California. This has to do with the weather. What was the weather like when the pilgrims landed? Mr. Adams.
The dashing waves break
at the foot of the land. So exactly.
Breaking waves dash high.
Yes, on a what?
Stern and rock-bound coast.
And what did the woods do?
The woods against a stormy sky, their giant branches tossed.
The coast. Right. What's that, Cullen?
I sang it when I graduated from Douglas School in Chicago.
Yes, but I'm thankful that that's over. Now, what was the weather like when the ghost of King Hamlet visited Elsinore? Mr. Adams.
Bitter cold.
That's absolutely right. Act 1, Scene 1, Line 8. Bitter cold. The weather when Stephen Foster was on his way to see Susanna. That's a tough one.
He had his banjo on his knee. But
yes, but that's not weather, Mr. Kellen. Mr. Adams.
Day was hot, the soul
was
dry.
Day was hot, and was something snowy at the same time.
Oh, no. It rained all night the day I left. The weather, it was dry. The sun so hot, which was the part you got right, Mr. Adams. I froze to death. Susanna, don't you cry. Oh, we got 2 out of 3.
Well,
in fact,
hot,
so
hot, I froze to death. That's what I meant.
That's all right. All right, Mr. Adams. Very good. Now, the goings-on this evening so far have cost Canada Dry a total of $20 in total. Now, a word from Mr. Milton Cross, and I'll be back with news of next week's guests.
One of the outstanding reasons for the wholesome goodness of Canada Dry Ginger Ale is the care with which it is made. For not only are the finest ingredients used, but laboratory tests are made to doubly ensure their quality. Every step in the making of this fine drink is under the supervision of graduate chemists who leave nothing undone in making Canada Dry the world's finest, the champagne of ginger ales. Now, if the drinks you've been serving with meals this summer begin to have a wearying note of sameness, here's a suggestion we think you'll appreciate. Next time you serve iced tea, mix Canada Dry ginger ale with it, half and half. It's cooling and delightfully different. No trouble at all to make, and just the thing to give a sparkle to lagging appetites. Why not serve it for dinner tomorrow? It's a treat the whole family will enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Beebe and Mr. Kellen, for coming down to the aid of Canada Dry's party this evening. And next week's lineup will include that veteran trio, Adams, Kieran, and Levant, plus, as our guest of honor, the outspoken mayor of San Antonio, Texas, former congressman from that state, and author of the recent book, In Blood and Ink. I refer, of course, to the picturesque Maury Maverick. Now, to all you listeners, we say, please send your questions along, and if you have a stumper to stump our board of experts, let's have it. There are $5 in it for you if we use your question, and another 10 if we fail to answer it correctly. So you can win 15 in all. Send your letters with questions to Information, Please, 1 Pershing Square, New York City.
Among the hosts of Canada Dry beverages, you are bound to enjoy these summer favorites. Canada Dry Tom Collins Mixer and Canada Dry Lime Ricky. Both made with genuine fruit base and the finest ingredients. No preservatives or artificial flavoring. So for cooling tall drinks with a lemon flavor, order Canada Dry's Tom Collins Mixer. For a lime flavor, insist on Canada Dry Lime Ricky. The family size is economical, costing only 15 cents. This is Milton Cross saying, good night all.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.